use the word exclusive a lot in the news industry, as in a Channel 9 exclusive coming up at 11. It's meant to tease and attract, offer something of value that you can't get anywhere else. Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of May 22nd, 2015. In our economy, exclusivity is everywhere. Maybe something you want but haven't been invited to have, or a door open only for the 1%. Today, we're exploring exclusivity in tech, music, healthcare, and more. Do you spend your money to have an exclusive experience? We want to know. Tell us by visiting marketplaceweekend.org and clicking on Go. Visit the Marketplace Facebook page or tweet us at MarketplaceWKND. We're going to start with an industry that's shaping the future of our lives and where exclusivity is dictated by what you hold in your hand when you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
We have our phones in the studio today.
Yes.
We are talking about ecosystem exclusivity.
Yes.
That is a super mouthful, but it basically means what?
It means that you and I, Lizzie, you're an iPhone.
Yep.
And I'm an Android.
Yep.
So let's do a little experiment here.
I'm going to try to, here, let's see, Ben Johnson.
Do you want to,
I can't FaceTime you.
You can't FaceTime me.
Okay.
But maybe I could Google Hangout you. Can you do that?
I don't have
Are
that.
Are you like into the,
I don't,
you know?
Not on my.
Oh.
Okay. And if I, so if I text you.
Okay.
Hey.
Yeah. Send me a text,
dude.
I guess. Yeah.
Nope. Goes through green. And with you texting back, I don't get the exciting three dots of knowing that you're replying.
I'm replying right now, Izzy.
Ugh.
Can you tell that I'm replying?
Nope.
See, this is an example, Lizzie, of why ecosystems don't always work together, right?
A really basic one.
Really, really basic. We like to keep it basic. So it's different software. If you live in an Apple ecosystem, you don't have as many options to interact with Google users or Android software and vice versa. Another example, you know, might be actual hardware. So like if you have an Android phone, that doesn't work necessarily very well with your Macintosh,
that,
for instance.
That makes sense. So these are different ecosystems. The text color thing, right?
Yep.
So my messages to you are green. They are not blue as and if they were if I were iMessaging.
And they're green because they're the color of money. And Apple is telling you that if you send an iMessage to one of your iMessage pals, then it'll be free. But if you text me, it will actually go like cost you some of your texts.
Okay. So those are ecosystems not meshing. What happens when they do play right? What does that look like?
Well, actually, let's talk about a few like fails first. So like Apple Maps, do you remember this?
Yes.
This is when Apple was really not wanting to have Google Maps be part of people's devices, Apple devices, and tried to do its own maps and roll it out, and it was terrible. Apple users hated Apple Maps. They didn't work very well. And then Apple, of course, rolled that back and brought Google Maps back onto Apple phones. Microsoft recently made its Office software more usable on Apple products.
Right.
So there's the other side of this too. You know, companies are sort of saying, okay, let's actually have some of these things play nice with each other. You can get Google Drive on your phone, which is Google's storage service, even if you're an Apple user. But big tech companies are always making efforts to have their own ecosystems give you everything, and so that you basically stay in that ecosystem. Facebook is a good example of this.
Well, so let's talk about something like Facebook or
sure.
a third-party application.
Yeah.
Presumably, they want this to work everywhere, right?
Sure. And, you know, a lot of third-party companies, maybe if it's Snapchat or if it's WhatsApp or Viber or some of these messaging services, they want to work on all phones. And another interesting thing happens with developers where developers will often make, for instance, an Apple app or an iPhone app before they will make Android apps because it's much easier to make an Apple app and have it work on all of Apple's ecosystem devices, whereas when they go to make the Android app, it has to work on a bunch of different kinds of phones. So there are problems there too.
Does this ecosystem exclusivity seem like it's going to be something that affects more of our lives in the future, or
less techie parts of our lives?
The battle for openness and the battle for closed ecosystems continues, Lizzie. So as we go forward into a world where there's virtual reality, where there are wearable devices that go into your clothes or on your wrist or, you know, around your necklace, things like that, a lot of companies are going to be trying to build smart refrigerators that work with smart toasters on a sort of closed system of software. Samsung wants you to buy all Samsung devices, for instance. But there will be other companies that are trying to build open platforms that will work for any device, no matter who makes it and who makes the software for it. So there's this real battle constantly going on between companies that really value openness and want to gain users and companies that really value sort of closed systems and want to keep users.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
We're going to stay with tech and the idea of exclusivity now, but talk about larger questions in our economy and society. Over the past few years, companies like Uber, Lyft, TaskRabbit, Instacart have sprouted up all over the place. Some people call it the on-demand economy. Apps that provide services for a fee, usually also advertising convenience for the user. We wanted to talk about the societal effects of this boom. So we're turning to Farhad Manju, a technology columnist for The New York Times. Hi, Farhad. How are you?
Pretty good. Good to be here.
You wrote a column looking at one of the big questions that I have, which is, are all of these apps, or what we sort of call the on-demand economy, creating a more exclusive world, and for whom? What'd you find?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. In one way, you could say it's actually creating a less exclusive world because it's allowing kind of stuff that used to be available only for the super, super rich people to now it's that stuff is accessible to the kind of like the modestly wealthy rich people. So in that way, you know, you are democratizing something, but it's sort of services that in the past were available to a very, very tiny portion of the population.
One of the things you looked at, which I thought was totally fascinating, is a startup that creates a ride service for children, basically Uber to like drive your kids around.
Yeah.
Which seemed to me like it would be something that would be really useful if you are a single mom or you have a lot of things on your plate and you're trying to make it all work. On the other hand, it's expensive. How does the money work?
It costs $12 a ride now, which is pretty expensive. That's more expensive than Uber, for example. It's $12 per ride, so you can put, if you have two kids, you can put them in there for half the price, essentially. But the reason it's expensive is because it's a complicated service to do. So they have to hire people who are much more experienced at taking care of kids than normal kind of Uber drivers. So it's more complicated than something like Uber, and it's also small. So the way that these services, things like Uber, kind of get cheaper over time is through scale. The more riders they have, the more drivers they have, the more sort of number of people they can add to each car goes down, and so that reduces the price.
A lot of these services are used by the well-off or the young, very tech-savvy. What do we know about the user bases for them? Are they expanding, or is it really in this kind of narrow band of people?
I mean, there's a reason they all start up in San Francisco, and it's because San Francisco is sort of a hotbed of tech-savvy, young, pretty wealthy people, people who work at tech companies, who are also extremely busy, and so who are, you know, open to outsourcing their lives to these services. The question is whether they can kind of expand beyond those, and some have. I mean, Uber is the biggest on-demand service, and it's also the best example of this possibility. You know, if you go by that example, you could say that if these other services scale, you know, at that kind of radical pace, they may be able to serve everyone.
There have been a lot of conversations about wages and benefits for the largely contractors who work for a lot of these companies. You talked to some people who said, you know, this may just sort of bifurcate the labor market and be a predictor of what we see in the future. Do the companies feel that way?
The companies are pretty wary about talking about their labor practices because, you know, for example, Uber drivers, you could say they're flexible. They're not controlled by Uber because they can turn on and off their app at any time. And many of them can also work for Lyft. But they also have to sort of maintain their cars to the service that Uber wants. They can't do things. There are a bunch of different requirements to be part of Uber. And in that way, they may be considered employees. So it's a big question. And for that reason, I think these companies don't really like to talk about it.
All of these services are predicated on the idea that someone has a smartphone, can pay for it, and knows how to use it. Are we at risk of creating a permanent sort of tech-savvy overclass, do you think?
No, I think that's one area where there's cause for optimism. I mean, I think most of the surveys that I've seen on this have suggested that smartphones have actually helped to kind of bridge the digital divide. What we've seen is that many people in the United States who have low incomes use smartphones exclusively as their computers. And that is more true in the developing world, where sort of the smartphone and big phones and small tablets are essentially the computers in those areas. And so I think these devices may help kind of increase access to the digital world. The question is whether is about these services, I think, whether those prices will come down to kind of be accessible to those people.
Is there money for investors who back these companies in scaling to the middle class or to moderate income customers?
It depends. I think that there are some that will only work at scale. And so their whole mission and their whole economic viability is to get to scale. This is like the food service company that I talked about called Munchery. I mean, their aim, they deliver food to you that's kind of restaurant quality, but it's delivered to your house. And they can only work if their prices kind of get down to competition with like Chipotle. If it's sort of their prices are available only to the wealthy, I don't think they would have satisfied their investors.
Farhad Manjoo is a technology columnist for The New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Focused on the exclusive in today's show, but before we get back to that, let's look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks those figures and serves them up at marketplace.org. Here are digital producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe with this week's numbers. Go for it, Tobin.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
16.1 million.
That's how much Chinese e-commerce site Alibaba says it spends fighting counterfeit goods every year. But not everyone thinks they're doing all they can. This week, several luxury brands filed a suit against Alibaba. They claim Alibaba assists counterfeiters in the sale of fake products.
5.8 trillion.
That's the size of the market for managing 401ks. And this week, the Supreme Court ruled that employees have the right to sue if they think their employers aren't fighting high management fees.
5,767.
That's how many times postal workers were bitten by dogs last year. That's up almost 200 bites. Rough break, postal workers.
Ugh, boo, boo.
We're focused on exclusivity on the show this week. One sector that's in the middle of a ton of change right now is healthcare. Insurance is vastly more accessible now than it was a few years ago, and things like telemedicine have also increased access. On the other hand, expensive services like concierge medicine are also booming. We spoke with Dr. Molly Coy, Chief Innovation Officer at UCLA Health, and I started by asking her whether she thinks healthcare is more or less exclusive now than it used to be.
I think healthcare today is far less exclusive than it was 5 years ago, and all the signs are that this is going to be an accelerating trend. Healthcare is much more accessible.
And yet, if you look at things like concierge services or even some of these sort of primary care doctors that charge maybe a $200 flat fee a year, which I wouldn't call kind of the high end of concierge, those businesses seem to be booming. What does that tell you about what people want?
I think that what that says is that the market is segmenting quite dramatically, and the proportion of people who can afford those services in our country is very small. It gets a lot of attention, but that doesn't constitute the bulk of the way care is being delivered. Most people are getting their care through a combination, increasingly, of mobile and digital means and traditional physician office visits, clinics, or emergency rooms.
You look at a lot of innovation. Where do you think mobile and digital healthcare is going in the next couple of years?
There's great evidence that consumers are really pushing this, that even the elderly, when they go home from a hospital stay, for example, are very pleased to have mobile devices that they can use to stay in close touch with their teams. And it's winding up preventing complications, keeping them from having to come to the emergency room or back into the hospital. So there are very few areas of healthcare where this doesn't offer an important part of the solution.
Does that ever worry you as a doctor that you can't, you know, put your hands on a patient if you're talking about telemedicine?
I don't think so, but you have to remember that for the last 30 or 40 years, lots of doctors took care of patients by telephone. Hmm. The patient would call and say, I have this kind of an ache or a pain, and if they live 20 miles or 40 miles away, the doctor felt quite comfortable usually saying either, it's really going to be okay, keep doing what you're doing, or I'm worried about this and I want you to come in. You can do that with the telehealth and telemedicine as well.
I read an interview you gave and you sort of said what was ailing the system was a failure to listen to patients. So how does that get incorporated into kind of the different ways that healthcare is changing as we move forward?
There actually is a very large movement in medicine now to listen to patients and to redesign the way we provide care by listening to what they really want and prefer. That's led to huge changes in the way we deliver care. So it really is a very big change in the way we provide care. It's not everywhere, but this approach is spreading.
We talk about inequality on this show a lot. And I guess when you think about healthcare system change, how big of a concern is economic inequality for you when you think about designing the healthcare system of the future?
Economic inequality is going to continue to be a real challenge because if you look at the data on the boomer population and their failure to save, we're going to have a lot of relatively poor seniors in the next couple of decades. But the great thing is that many aspects of the ACA currently, and if they're extended and improved, really can help to address that for healthcare. So not only it's access to insurance, but it's also to be able to get care that will be more effective so that you don't need as much medical care to stay healthy.
Who bears the cost of a lot of relatively poor seniors then?
The cost of relatively poor seniors will be a public cost largely because people who have not saved are not going to be able to afford to pay for a lot of the expensive medicines that are coming down the line now.
When you think about innovation in healthcare, what's the most important innovation right now?
I think the most important innovation right now is actually a whole series of innovations that meet consumers and patients where they are, that bring to their home and to them in the community the tools they need to monitor their health, to communicate with their physicians, and to manage their own health. And we see tremendous changes, and people's lives change because they're able to really manage their health.
Dr. Molly Coy is the Chief Innovation Officer at UCLA Health. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
place you may spend some money this weekend, a bar or club. The nightlife industry brings in about $24 billion in revenue every year, and exclusivity is a special ingredient in that success. Why do we stand in line, for example, if there's an empty place down the street? We turn to John Taffer. He's a bar consultant, author, and probably best known as the host of the reality series Bar Rescue on Spike. He spoke to us from his hotel room in California, where he was on a trip working on a bar. John Taffer, welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Good to be here, Lizzie.
So I really want to know, how much in your business does exclusivity matter?
Exclusivity in my business tends to be regional, believe it or not.
Really?
And tends to, yes, it tends to focus in major markets. And of course, the leader of the whole exclusivity business in nightlife is Las Vegas, who, of course, sells tables for $5,000 or $10,000. You'll pay $1,500 for a bottle of vodka. And the amount of exclusivity that happens in Vegas nightlife is quite unique. It fits outside the U.S. norm. Facilities like XS at Wynn will have 91 VIP tables.
Oh, my
and
God.
Typically, each table has a value of about $10,000 on it.
When you think about the bottom line, do VIP areas make money, or is it the sort of hoi polloi that makes money?
I'm very analytical in that. I'll take a look at an operation and I will analyze its sales per square foot. So I will look at the total square footage that I have, I'll divide my revenue into it, and I'll know what I'll do. The average bar in America will do somewhere around $200 to $220 per square foot in sales. To give you a marker, the highest I've seen in America this year is that same nightclub I mentioned earlier, XS at Wynn Las Vegas, that achieved $2,700 per foot in sales. Now, that's the highest I've ever seen per square foot. When you consider what a square foot is, that's a remarkable number.
Well, why did they do that?
Well, they have those 91 VIP tables that generate between $10,000 and $20,000 income every night.
So there, being a VIP, you know, really helps out the bottom line for the business. Yeah.
Well, right down the street is Hakkasan. Hakkasan is 20,000 square feet bigger and does less money because it has less VIP tables.
It seems to me like there's a tension here kind of between exclusivity on the one hand is attractive, but then isn't volume good? Don't you want to get a lot of people in the door?
Well, I totally agree with you. And, you know, to me, the opposite of exclusivity is inclusivity. And when you're inclusive in your business, obviously you open up a much larger footprint and you can generate far more volume in dollars. That's the whole point of exclusivity in hospitality. It's a limited market and it is a niche market. And that's why you see very, very few boutique hotels in secondary markets. You see them all in primary markets from a hotel standpoint. Exclusivity is very much limited to primary markets and tourist markets. When you look at nightlife, the same model really holds. And the reason why is you have to have a large population base or tourist base from which to extract that niche of exclusivity and have it add up to enough bodies.
And there's a whole science behind this. I mean, you look at income brackets and kind of who different places are targeting. This seems to me like a lot of the economics of this really hinge on knowing exactly who you're serving.
Oh, it is. And when we look at markets, we'll pick apart not only demographics. For example, I'm working in a market just outside of San Diego now. And I know that the median household income is $82,000 a year. I know the median age is 34.6 years old. I know that it's almost an even Caucasian and Latin marketplace, so it's very diverse. I know the percentage that are married. I know who's in college. I know who the top 10 employers are. And I have a demographic and psychographic snapshot of the marketplace. I'm not building the bar for the owner. I'm not building it for myself. I'm building it for the market. And I better darn well know it.
One thing that I'm interested in is the psychology behind all of this. Why do we stand in line? Why do I want to go to the place that, you know, I might have to be outside for 20 minutes? Are we just like sheeple?
Well, you know what's interesting? The college textbooks will say that there's five things that must be present for you to go to a food and beverage operation again and again and again. And those five things quickly are convenience, price value, service quality, food and beverage quality, and cleanliness, those five things. But yet, if you go to a place and have a really wonderful time, you will stand in line. That's not convenient. you will pay higher prices. That's not value. Sometimes you'll step over the puddles in the bathroom where there's no paper towels just because the place is so cool. I'm not in a logical business. I'm in an emotional business. And my job is to connect with something that is bigger than you. Your greatest time of your life, you know, the greatest experience of your life, to make your stomach vibrate and to connect in more of a reactionary or emotional way, not a logical way. And if I can add, my business is not about absolute value. Hmm. Absolute value says, heck, I can get some orange juice and vodka and make a drink at home for under a dollar. Why would I go to Taffer's Bar and spend $11? My business is about perceived value. And only you can make the perception for you.
Is everything going towards a more exclusive experience, or does it just vary depending on where you are?
It really varies based upon where you are. And keep in mind that nobody's going to go to a nightclub and spend $10,000 on a table every week or even every month. These are special occasion situations, typically. They typically happen in tourist or very, very major markets where, again, you have the market density to be able to pull it off. But at the end of the day, hospitality is best served by inclusivity, not exclusivity, as an overall strategy. And when we analyze it by sales per foot, Lizzie, it really does prove that out.
John Taffer is a nightlife consultant, author, and the host and executive producer of Bar Rescue. Thank you so much.
Great to be here. Let's talk soon.
Like nightlife, a lot of the music business thrives on exclusivity.
Well, I'm a song and dance man named Josh Tillman, who gave himself the admittedly ridiculous stage name Father John Misty.
Musicians, especially those who are up and coming, play a lot of shows and festivals. A lot.
I've played the Great Googa Mooga Food Festival in Brooklyn. Let's see, the Newport Chowder Bonanza, Austin's Scrap Heap Sweepstakes, Gorgonzola. I've played a few PBS telethons, you name it.
Okay, fine. Some of those are not 100% real. What is real is something called a radius clause. That means if you play at one venue or festival, you can't play at another one in a certain radius for a certain period of time. The artist is exclusive to the venue. Tillman thinks it loses musicians money. Here's his take.
A radius clause. A festival promoter will quarantine you to the bottom floor of a hotel for no less than 6 months around a scheduled performance, part of a music festival. But I mean, I did have my album came out. I had an album that came out within the radius clause for Coachella, and that was kind of, you know, I mean, I ended up having to play a way smaller, basically unprofitable, like album release show because of a radius clause.
Exclusivity isn't limited just to venues.
But, I mean, we do little things like they'll get an exclusive T-shirt or something. Like, we'll design a T-shirt that is only available, like, through the Sub Pop store or something, and they get a percentage of that. But none of the money from, you know, live performances or whatever else is Sub Pop's jurisdiction.
And as a business, well, exclusivity can hurt or help an artist make money, like a private show.
This company, Vinyl Me Please, they did like a private party around the time that they put my album out. So I went and played that because it's coherent and it makes sense. But I typically do not go play. You know, I get asked to do all kinds of horrible shit, like a Jack Daniels party or a Yahoo party, or, you know, I mean, just executives, you know, or you know, getting asked to go play like Bumble Scrimp Campus, you know, or some like social media, whatever. And I mean, I also don't, you know, I don't do commercials. which is majorly cutting myself off at the knees financially. The dignified revenue streams are playing live and you know, maybe merch, you know, if I can make that thing have dignity. I mean, I think the best analogy I can really think of is like Wile E. Coyote or something. I mean, you just go running off the cliff and you keep just running through thin air and just make sure you don't look down. I'm in a position, I think by this summer I'll be solvent, you know, and I'll be actually making money.
That's Josh Tillman, who performs with the stage name Father John Misty.
How many people rise and say, my brain's so awfully glad to be here for yet another mindless day. Now I've got all morning to obsessively accrue a small nation of meaningful objects, and they've gotta represent me too.
We've been talking about exclusivity today in the economy, tech, healthcare. Now, our wallets. A lot of us carry around little membership cards of sorts every day. Credit cards. Access to money, loans, all sorts of things. We wanted to know more about how exclusive credit actually is and how to get a score that gets you the best offers. Michelle Singletary writes the nationally syndicated personal finance column, The Color of Money. It appears in the Washington Post. Welcome back, Michelle.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Okay, so I open my mail sometimes and I get, you know, envelopes saying, exclusive offer. They're dangling more credit cards in front of me. I'm curious, how exclusive are they? I mean, how many of us actually have really good credit?
More than most people think. About 23% have really good credit. Basing it on the FICO score, which is the score that most lenders still use, it's on a scale of 300 to 850, 850 being a perfect score, 300 meaning, ooh, you've got a lot of issues going on. When you get those exclusive offers, essentially they've looked at your credit files and said, you know what, this person is probably going to be a good risk. Doesn't mean that you automatically get credit, but they have looked at your file to think that, okay, I think that this person is going to be okay for us to have new business with.
When we think about kind of where we fall on this spectrum, what are the best ways to establish credit and improve it? I mean, this was something I knew nothing about when I was young.
You know, people think that there's so many tricks to getting a good credit score, but the number one way to get a good credit score is to pay your bills on time. When you look at the scale, the factors that, say, FICO look at, two main factors that take up the bulk of what they look at, paying your bills on time and how much credit you have outstanding. So the two things, pay your bills down and pay them off on time. And then you'll be in that exclusive club of people who have credit scores of, say, 700 or more.
Can you do that without a credit card? You know, could you do it if you're young, say, with student loans?
Absolutely. The factors that go into a credit score include revolving accounts like credit card accounts. It includes student loans, if you've got a mortgage, a car payment. So there are other things that you can do to get a good credit score.
One of the things that surprised me so much learning about this stuff was that the credit score was actually invented to make credit less exclusive, more democratized. Can you explain the history a little bit?
Back in the day, I'm not that old, so, but back in the day, a lender would call your merchant and say, hey, how is Michelle? Does she pay her bills on time? She's got a layaway plan. Does she miss any payments? It was much more subjective than it is now. And so once they invented the credit score, the two gentlemen out in California, then they sort of put it more, you know, numerical, mathematical. They're looking at just the numbers, not necessarily who you are as a person.
But credit can still be exclusionary and certainly targets certain populations.
That's correct. I mean, there's some people who criticize it because, for example, lots of minorities may not own a home, which is a huge part of what goes into that type of mortgage, goes in your credit score. So if you are a renter, your on-time rental payments aren't considered in the traditional FICO score. And so that could eliminate some good history for a great number of people, oftentimes minorities.
How much change are we seeing? I mean, some states have said bad credit can't bar you from getting a job. Is that sort of change going to continue, do you think?
You know, I think it's not. I think we have used the credit score, and there are different types of credit scores. You can get an insurance credit score. You can get a credit score based on how you handle credit. And more employers are pulling it to see what your credit history is, what your credit score is. So we're not using it less, but I think that we are recognizing that, for example, let's put in rental payments. The newest FICO score eliminates medical debt because that they've shown that even though you might be in medical debt, before that, you paid your debts on time. So that it's evolving to look at these sort of nuances, and that's a good thing, so that that exclusive club can open up to more people.
What do you do if your credit's not so hot? A lot of people are in that state and want to rehab it a little bit.
If you've gotten off to a bad track, that you're, you know, paying your bills late, maybe you lost your job, you couldn't pay some things, but now you've got a job, you're getting back to the way you were before. Again, number one way, pay your bills on time. And here's what people don't realize. It's the new incidents that hurt your credit score the worst. So let's say you had a late bill 5 years ago, as opposed to a late bill just 30 days ago or 90 days ago. That 90-day or 30-day late payment is going to impact your credit score more than that one 5 years ago. And then if you don't have credit cards, you can get what's called a secure credit card. And so you put money into a bank account and your credit line becomes that money that's in the bank, say $250. You use that for, you know, several months, and then you'll start to get regular credit card offers. You get that card, charge a couple things on it, pay it off on time in full, put it in the drawer, you begin to rehabilitate your credit. So I really want to encourage people, don't pay people to rehabilitate credit. You can do these things yourself. If you go to MyFICO online, there's lots of tips. And then FTC, Federal Trade Commission, has a great site with a lot of good tips to show you, to walk you through how to repair your credit yourself.
When we talk about exclusivity, which we've been doing this week, you know, there are these whole modes of credit, certain cards, black cards, metal cards. The whole business model is built about being exclusive. Are those worth it? I mean, some of those come with really hefty fees.
I think for the average consumer, they are not. If you're doing a lot of credit card business, you know, thousands per month, it can be worth it because you get some perks that might be, you know, worth it to you. If you're a frequent user of a certain airline or service and you want to get that reward card because you want to build up some points to get, you know, a trip or something like that, okay. But, you know, this whole idea of a black platinum card or whatever, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's only for the people that are way out there, and most of us are not there. I would just caution people to always remember, however, even with these special exclusive reward cards, that studies show when you use plastic, debit or credit, you tend to spend more than if you use cash. So you're saying, oh, I'm racking all of the points, but you're also racking up a lot of spending to get those points. And it may be spending that you wouldn't normally do had you not had a reward card.
Exclusivity, I guess, is just a way to kind of bring you in.
That's exactly right. It's a game. Most of us don't win at it. Am I saying don't use credit? No. But don't be so proud of being in this exclusive reward card club and end up spending more than you intend to.
Michelle Singletary is a personal finance columnist and writes the nationally syndicated column, The Color of Money. As always, thank you, Michelle.
You're so welcome.
When we think about the debate over inequality in this country, a central piece of American mythology is that anyone who works hard, regardless of their social status, can get ahead. But of course, it's not that simple, and people from exclusive or affluent backgrounds often land the most prestigious jobs. Professor Lauren Rivera has been looking at investment banks, consulting firms, and law firms for the last decade for her upcoming book, Pedigree: How Elite Students Get Elite Jobs. She's an associate professor at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So you wrote this book about how elite students get elite jobs. Tell me about your research. It's pretty fascinating.
So I studied the hiring practices of top-tier investment banks, management consulting firms, and law firms. So what I did for the research, which is the basis of my forthcoming book, is I interviewed 120 decision makers in these firms. These are people who were charged with evaluating candidates, making actual hiring decisions. They range from people who were a couple years out of business or law school to people who were seasoned hiring partners in their 60s. And I really just talk to them about the hiring practices in their firms. But to couple the conversations I had with them, I also spent close to a year, about 9 months as an ethnographer in one of these firms, really observing every aspect of the hiring process. So I was actually an HR staff person for these 9 months, and I got an inside look into the backstage of elite hiring.
What did you see behind the scenes? Because so many of the big firms out there say they have broad commitments to diversity and to bringing in lots of different kinds of employees.
They do. They do have public commitments to diversity. And a lot of people think that they're doing their best to get a diverse candidate pool. But what I really, really saw was the importance of applicant social class and how applicant social class backgrounds, such as their parents' level of income, education, really mattered for people's ability to successfully procure one of these jobs.
How much of that do you think was unconscious bias on the part of maybe hiring managers or interviewers who were comfortable with someone who felt like them?
I think a lot of it is unconscious. I don't really think firms go out there and say, hey, we only want to hire people who are upper class. What happens is that, as exactly as you said, people feel more comfortable with people who are from a similar social class background. And that's not only that emotional aspect of do I feel at ease around you, but do we actually have something to talk about? A lot of job interviews are based off of social chit-chat and just making conversation. And having played the same types of sports, growing up in the same types of neighborhoods, those sorts of things can create a bond among people.
To play devil's advocate, make the argument for me to a firm as to why they should change their hiring practices.
You could make an equity argument saying that, hey, you want the best and the brightest regardless of social background. If you're not systematically looking at over half the best and brightest because they don't qualify in terms of social background, you know, that is not necessarily an equitable or open process. I'm going to guess that most firms, that's not their top priority. And there's actually some evidence, some research that's being done to suggest that students who come from the most elite backgrounds in terms of the most prestigious schools, as well as the highest class backgrounds, actually are worse fits with the jobs in banking, consulting, and law. They may not have the coursework, the actual training necessarily to do the job, and they require more on-the-job training. But perhaps more importantly, these are really, really difficult jobs, and students from the most prestigious universities and from the highest class backgrounds tend to be the most miserable on the job. And they tend to want to leave them within 1 to 2 years of entering them. And this is way before they've been there long enough to pay off recruiting costs on the part of the firm. By contrast, students from less elite backgrounds in terms of less socioeconomically privileged and or less elite schools tend to actually like the content of the work and want to stay long term.
Lauren Rivera is an associate professor at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Breaking Bad last night.
Oh my God, no spoilers. No, we haven't watched it yet. We TiVo'd it.
We just finished the first season.
That's the best television I've ever seen. The way they do it, and Gus.
No, we haven't seen it.
Spoiler alert. Stop.
It's happened to all of us. You fall a little bit behind on a TV show, or you're on the West Coast and you look at the internet and spoiler. And yeah, that was Portlandia we spoiled for you just now. Spoilers are everywhere, and whether you're seeking them out or stumbling across them by accident, it's likely you've had the ending of a show or a movie ruined. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson knows a little something about spoilers and how they get in the way of exclusivity. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, Lizzie.
So a while back, you spoiled the ending of House of Cards. Season 2, months after the season had ended. What happened?
I did. So I was doing a story about net neutrality, and I used House of Cards as an example, and I thought I was being safe and considerate by not talking about season 3, which had just been released, but I did mention something from season 2, which had been out for over a year at that point, and I got lots of angry emails or in tweets, definitely the angriest emails I've ever gotten from listeners about a story I've done. One man wrote in and said, "Unfortunately, for many people who don't have the time or inclination to soak up a TV series as soon as they are available, just blurting out that," and this is the spoiler I gave, so spoiler alert, "just blurting out that Frank is the president has already spoiled it for those of us who are still making our way through seasons 1 or 2 or haven't gotten around to watching the show at all yet." He said, "I showed a lack of consideration for a large portion of my audience."
So this started a huge debate in our office about the statute of limitations for spoilers. I argued you were fine. It'd been a year.
Yes. I appreciate your support, but I did feel a little guilty, and I wrote personally to every single one who wrote me and apologized. I didn't lose sleep over it, but I probably wouldn't do it again, and I would probably do one of those, you know, spoiler alert, turn down your radio type of thing.
This is a big cultural thing. There's a Portlandia sketch about it that we heard. People do a lot to have this exclusive experience. So, if you don't want to be spoiled, what do you do?
I mean, first of all, for the love of God, stay off Twitter before a big season finale. But there's also some apps or services, websites that you can use to kind of quote unquote mute different streams, different terms, if you're trying to, you know, watch the Olympics, for example, without having it be spoiled for you. Google has a plugin called Silencer, and they've also recently applied for some sort of patent related to this that they're not talking about yet. Weirdly enough, though, there were some researchers who back in 2011 from the University of San Diego did a study, and they found that people who read a short story preferred to have a summary, a spoiler, basically, of the story. They enjoyed it more. I gotta say, I totally disagree with that, but that was the finding of their research.
Preventing spoilers, though, is a business model. I mean, some TV network shows, they go really far to keep everything secret before it airs.
Right. That is the premise of the network exclusive, right? That they've gotten exclusive rights to some sort of interview, and they don't want any information that is going to come out in that interview to be shared early. So we saw that recently with Diane Sawyer's recent interview with Bruce Jenner about transitioning to live as a woman, or ABC's The Bachelor. They desperately try and keep who the, you know, guy or girl picked in the end, whether or not they proposed, all that stuff. They try and keep that secret, even while there's a whole slew of bloggers and people on the internet trying to figure out ahead of time, analyzing contestants' social media streams to see how long they were offline and trying to figure out who won in the end.
Which brings us to the end of a show that keeps everything under wraps, or did. Have you seen the Mad Men series finale, Tracy?
I have not seen it. No spoilers.
So, okay, here's what happens. It's a total dream.
I can't hear you.
Don wakes up in 1970, and it was all fake, and that's the end.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thank you, Tracy. P.S. I made that all up, and I didn't spoil anything. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for the week. Next week, we'll be looking at major generations and some of the big issues facing each of them. So baby boomers, Gen Xers, millennials, or if you're like me, the Oregon Trail generation, tune in, learn about each other. Also, we're looking at your money across the years, and we want to know, what's the first thing you ever saved up to buy? Let us know by visiting marketplaceweekend.org and clicking on Go. Hit us up on Facebook or tweet us at MarketplaceWKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Chris Clark is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.